Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit. This episode of Groundwire will look back at the significant stories from the last half of 2018. Here is your 2018 Year in Review, Part 2. First, some headlines from the second half of 2018. Our first headline comes from the July 30th episode of Groundwire, covering the Assembly of First Nations election by Michael Welsh at CKUW and Gennardio Sullivan at CFRO.
The week of July 23rd, the Assembly of First Nations assembled in Vancouver, the traditional territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations, for their annual General Assembly. A major controversy springing from the event was the presence of Carolyn Bennett, the Federal Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations, at the AFN's caucus meetings during the election of the National Chief. Co-op Radio's Gunargio Sullivan was present at the AFN gathering and managed to get comments from Pam Palmiter, academic, Mi'kmaq lawyer, and past candidate for AFN National Chief.
I think it's completely inappropriate for any federal or provincial high-level minister or deputy minister to be anywhere on the premises when an election is happening, because it can be construed as government interference, undue influence, or even bias from the other candidates. So that's something that should never happen in an AFN election.
Full coverage of the AFN AGA is available in the cooperadio.org archives for the July 26th show, KLA Hauya FM.
Our next headline comes from the October 8th episode, where Catherine Fisher at CJLY covers the BC Supreme Court ruling on the Jumbo Glacier Resort.
This September, at the annual general meeting of the Union of British Columbia Municipalities in Whistler, BC, delegates discussed and voted on 143 resolutions, including two calling on the provincial government to amend the Private Managed Forest Land Act to bring it in line with regulations and forestry practices on public land. The Regional District of Central Kootenay decided to bring the resolution forward because of concerns about private land logging by the Nelson Land Corporation near Cottonwood Lake and Windell in southeastern BC. Private managed forest companies are not required to manage the land for the long term, and there are numerous examples of land being logged, then taken out of the managed forest and sold as real estate or for other types of development. This often results in adverse impacts on wildlife, water, and nearby communities, increasing risk of floods and impacting fish habitat by degrading riparian areas.
You are tuned in to Groundwire Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio station. Now we look back at some features from the second half of 2018 on Groundwire. Our first feature comes from our July 2nd episode covering struggles against Ottawa's largest mass eviction by Neil Rockwell at CKUT.
In our final feature, we profile a group in Ottawa trying to stop what's being called the largest mass eviction in Canada, one that principally targets the racialized and non-English as a first language population. Issues of gentrification and affordable housing are in play in this story, brought to us by Neil Rockwell of Montreal-based CKUT.
Heron Gate is Ottawa's most diverse neighborhood, being listed by Statistics Canada as more than 70% visible minority. The section between Heron and Walkley Roads is owned almost exclusively by one landlord, Timber Creek Asset Management. This portion is home to 4,000 people. Heron Gate was built in the 1960s by Minto. In 2007, they sold it to Transglobe Properties. Heron Gate has been in decline for decades, but things became much worse after the sale, with Transglobe massively neglecting the properties and refusing to do maintenance work. In 2013, Heron Gate was sold to Timber Creek, who in terms of maintenance were a slight improvement but continued to neglect buildings and were slow to perform maintenance, not fixing roofs, allowing mold to proliferate, replacing broken appliances with appliances from neighboring abandoned homes rather than buying new ones, and so forth. It should be noted that on my trips to Heron Gate, I've observed numerous violations of standards of maintenance bylaws. The complex is riddled with leaking roofs, vermin, trash, mold, and more. In 2016, Timber Creek demolished 83 townhomes, citing structural problems with the buildings. They are now building luxury high-rises in place of those units. Many of those tenants were moved to other properties in the Heron Gate complex, into homes which, this May, Timber Creek informed residents will soon be demolished to make way for more high-end units. In total, Timber Creek is now demolishing 150 units, 105 of which are currently occupied. The rest are currently abandoned. One such resident facing eviction for a second time in 2 years is Abdullahi Ali. Heron Gate is home to a very large Somali community.
This is the second time being evicted. We've been evicted before, 2-3 years ago. It's a lot of stress, and sometimes they say we cannot sleep even the whole night. It's really, really painful and very disgusting. They wanted to demolish these houses and spread all this community over different corners of the city. Yeah, that's too sad. We've been building this community for so many years, and easily destroyed by Timber Creek. It's unacceptable.
Many tenants, Ellie included, who feel that this neglect has been intentional, are organizing against Timber Creek. They have formed the Heron Gate Tenants Coalition with the intention of preserving their homes and community. The UN has taken an interest. Leilani Farha, the UN Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, spoke at a recent tenants' meeting, explaining how mass evictions are a human rights violation and how, under international law, governments and developers have a duty to create a plan with current residents.
Forced evictions are considered a gross violation of human rights, which means it's like the worst kind of violation of human rights that can happen. Under international human rights law, forced evictions should not happen, period, ever. There is a responsibility on the part of government to make sure that every alternative to the eviction is explored.
Timber Creek has tried to give the impression that they are helping residents relocate. But tenants I have spoke with say that Timber Creek has done nothing. Their relocation consultant is an engineering student, the son of one of the property managers. One of their flyers gave such advice as searching the terms home and rent on sites like Kijiji and Craigslist. Apart from the destruction of their community, many residents I've spoken with talk about the anxiety and sleepless nights they've experienced thinking about where they will go and what they will do, since all of the houses available are way out of their budget in the difficult Ottawa housing market. Many families will face homelessness. Amina Sheikh Ahmed told me that her mother will lose her business.
My mom owns a home daycare, and this is her source of income, and so we are being forced to move out, which will leave her jobless.
On top of this, I have been getting numerous reports of residents being intimidated and receiving false information from the property manager, Paul Boutros. According to several accounts, he has targeted people with poor English skills, telling them their locks will be changed and their things thrown out, in one case leaving a resident in tears. Resident Mohammed Iman discusses.
Yes, the management here. The manager, and I don't know the lady, but the ball is the manager. They harassing people that they don't know good English.
Another resident recently said that Boutros told him that resistance was hopeless because Timber Creek already possessed demolition permits. This is untrue because permits can only be issued once residents are vacated and all utilities disconnected. Another important issue is Timber Creek's rationale for why they must demolish these homes. In a vaguely worded notice to residents dated May 7th, 2018, they explained that these homes are, quote, reaching the end of their building life cycle, unquote. 50 years, however, does not seem particularly old for a building. And this also raises the question of why these particular units and not the others in the complex, which were built at the same time. Nonetheless, tenants have the impression that their homes are to be demolished because they are no longer structurally sound. Yet no one I spoke with can remember Timber Creek ever sending anyone to inspect the state of their home. Here's Heron Gate resident Tracy Heal.
In the 4 years that I've lived there, not once have they come by to have an inspection done. I'm not sure how they can claim that they're not livable if they've never seen what they look like.
Furthermore, a close reading of the May 7th notice reveals that Timber Creek themselves never explicitly cite structural concerns, instead using the much more ambiguous term viability. To quote, the long-term viability of the low-rise wood structure homes in this area is compromised. It has reached the point that the townhomes in this area will need to be demolished at the end of 2018, unquote. This raises questions about why this demolition needs to take place and why it must be carried out in such a rapid manner. In a post to the CTV Ottawa website, Timber Creek suggested that the timetable for the previous eviction was inflexible because residents had to be moved out before the city would issue demolition permits. This suggests that the timetable for eviction need not be as inflexible as Timber Creek indicates, and that development with direct input by residents is possible. For more information, please visit herongatetenants.ca and Heron Gate Tenant Coalition on Facebook. Follow on Instagram and Twitter with the handle at HerongateTC. Reporting from CKUT in Montreal, this is Neil Rockwell for Groundwire.
In our next feature from September 24th, Michael Welsh at CKUW covers youth Indigenous suicide.
September is World Suicide Prevention Month, an occasion for community members from charitable organizations, clinicians, politicians, and policymakers to individuals with lived experience of suicide attempts and loss to share understandings and highlight prevention strategies. The familiar messaging, however, is likely not going to mention suicides of Indigenous peoples as being an end product of capitalism and colonialism. This is the theme of a 2014 book written by Roland Christjohn and co-authored by Shaughnessy McKay, Dying to Please You, Indigenous Suicide in Contemporary Canada, reveals Indigenous suicide to be not merely a result of individual deficiencies and shortcomings, but a response to social and cultural forces outside that have assaulted them in a very real sense. Statistics on Indigenous suicides are not up to date, but according to figures dating back to 2000, the overall First Nations suicide rate was roughly double the Canadian average, and the suicide rate for youth between 15 and 24 was 5 to 7 times that of non-Indigenous youth. Christjohn is Oneida of the Haudenosaunee, a professor of Native Studies at St. Thomas University and a founder of the American Indian Movement in Canada. In a 2014 talk, Christjohn mentioned that he had lost a friend and fellow AIM founder decades ago and became disillusioned with standard psychological and individualistic approaches to addressing suicide in Indigenous peoples. He insists that Indigenous suicide is a direct consequence of a project of repression and assimilation.
What you have is there are social forces in societies in general that work against you wanting to commit suicide. But when those social forces break down, when people feel enemy, detached, aloof, unconnected, then they commit suicide. You see, Indian societies broke down. Our customs, our languages, our political structures, they fell apart. And because we are normless people, we suffer from enemy and we commit anomic suicide.
In an article published for Ricochet Media, Greg McDougall quotes from the book stating, quote, "Indigenous peoples in Canada are systematically misinformed about the nature of the forces arrayed against us as individual human beings. Does the mass of Indians who commit suicide understand that this is murder? Do they understand that their murder is being carried out by people under the facade of healing them?" Unquote. In the same Ricochet article, Shaughnessy McKay draws a parallel between the suicide crisis and the genocidal violence of the residential schools, noting that it took an outraged public to galvanize action. In Ottawa, a member of Parliament, Charlie Angus, is introducing a private member's motion called the National Suicide Prevention Action Plan, M174. Here's Angus from a press conference on the motion from May of this year.
Crisis after crisis in so many communities, in Lalash, in Attawapiskat. And we were here just recently over Wapakika when young people died so needlessly. So what we're saying is we need a national action plan because children and young people and seniors across this country continue to die.
Perhaps most encouragingly, grassroots action is being taken in the form of an online multimedia platform called We Matter. This is an Indigenous-led nonprofit organization committed to Indigenous youth empowerment, hope, and life promotion by communicating to youth that they matter and by providing resources and support for them as they cope with crisis.
People from across the country submit short videos, 1 to 2 to 3 minutes long, speaking right to camera, right to Indigenous youth who may be struggling or feeling alone, sharing their own stories and words of support.
There's messages from NHL hockey players.
You're not alone.
Musicians.
Never doubt yourself.
Politicians.
You matter to your community.
For details about the We Matter campaign, please visit the site wemattercampaign.org. In related news, the CBC Massey Lectures will feature Tanya Talaga, author of 7 Fallen Feathers about youth deaths in Thunder Bay. Listen for those lectures on the CBC radio program Ideas in late autumn. From Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota, this is CKOW's Michael Welch for Groundwire, with files from Greg McDougall of equitableeducation.ca.
From our October 8th episode, the CKUT News Collective covers the massed post-election demonstration against hatred and the Coalition Avenir Quebec in Montreal. Last November, more than 168 Montreal-based groups and over 2,000 individuals joined a mass demonstration against the hatred and racism prevalent in Quebec. Following the provincial election of right-leaning Coalition Avenir Quebec a year later, organizers of the demonstration called for another mass mobilization against racism on October 7th. Reacting to the normalization of FAR and alt-right discourse and action in the province and its co-optation of populist political parties like the CAQ, organizers of the event called for border abolition and an inclusive society based on solidarity and inclusion. CKUT's News Collective brings us coverage of the event.
You may be seen as angry. It's hard not to be angry when I'm getting profiled and getting my face slammed into the pavement. It's hard not to be angry when our mothers, our fathers are getting profiled, our brothers are getting killed, our sisters are getting killed, and nothing happens. No one speaks on this.
We are here at Place Emilie Gamelin at the demonstration against racism, xenophobia, and Islamophobia in Quebec, organized in part by Safa Shebi, Marilyn Lopez, and Al Harrington. I am speaking to
Joe Wallace.
And with whom do you work?
The Wolfpack Street Patrol, organized by Al Harrington.
What does the victory of Coalition Avenir Quebec represent for the province and for its migrant population?
The Coalition Avenir Quebec probably represents the same sort of menace for newcomers to Quebec that it does for a lot of the long-standing people here, which is that although much is made of the fact that they are explicitly targeting migrants, a substantial portion of CAQ senior membership are affiliated with Koch Industries think tanks. And whatever they intend to do to newcomers and indigenous people in Quebec, eventually they probably will inflict upon les vrais Québécois eventually in due time. We're just on the front line. We're just the canaries in the coal mine. There was always an implicit permission from the government to do what they please. There were only ever perfunctory gestures of acceptance from the federal or provincial or city government. But now, that has flipped from being implicit to not explicit in all ways, but explicit in certain ways. There is a certain amount of dog whistling and cultural signifiers being relayed to law enforcement, suggesting that they can do as they please and they can actually feel good about it. They've already started using the notwithstanding clause to enforce their vulgarized notion of laïcité within Quebec. They haven't even taken office yet, and they vow that this is what they intend to do. He has a majority, he has the will, he has a combination of either the explicit or the implicit support of any number of members of established Quebecois society. At this point, it doesn't seem like there's much that stands in his way other than potentially, with the right dedication and organization, movements like these. We'll see.
Our next feature is from October 22nd and covers the story of an Ottawa inmate seeking to regain citizenship and access to medical care by Matt Cicero at CKCU. On November 6, 2017, Dipan Badlakoti, a Canadian-born man made stateless in 2011, was arrested by the Ontario Provincial Police in connection with alleged weapons offenses. In this piece, we'll hear from Badlakoti, who has been engaged in a high-profile battle with Citizenship and Immigration Canada since his citizenship was stripped from him. We will also be hearing from Daniel Kaylee Doust, spokesperson for Justice for Dipan, and Diane Ralph, a supporter. Kaylee Doust and Ralph have been helping Badlakoti regain his citizenship and get access to medical care while imprisoned in the Ottawa-Carlton Detention Centre.
Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Matt Cicero. It's not the first time that Deepan Budlakhadi has spent time in the Ottawa Carlton Detention Center. He was there in 2010. It's where his immigration problems first began. Maybe he's turned full circle then, because today his immigration status is the cause of his incarceration. While some things have changed in the last 7 years, Budlakhadi was stripped of his citizenship in 2011, others have not. Racism, central to his loss of citizenship, is also a big part of why he's in the Ottawa Carlton Detention Center awaiting trial. Deepan Budlakhadi called me collect from the range where he's imprisoned. The recording's not the best. He's on an old phone in an old prison. In the background, you can hear the sounds of the 23 other prisoners he's incarcerated with.
When the whole thing started, it was racial profiling. I was held at Ottawa Carlton Detention Center, and a white guard, came up to me and asked me if I was a citizen or not. Based on that, he contacted CBSA, which is documented on access information request. Now, because of that process, I have gone down the road of being completely stateless. All my co-accused got bail.
Why do you think they received bail while you didn't?
My case is high profile in terms of immigration matters and the fact that I'm brown, I have a beard. The system itself is systemic racism inbred into the system. So it's harder for people of color to get bail than individuals that are Caucasian.
The Ottawa Carlton Detention Center, or OCDC, is known as one of the worst prisons in Ontario. Three prisoners committed suicide there in 2015 and 2016. This resulted in an inspection by then-Minister of Community Safety and Correctional Services, Yasser Naqvi, as well as a task force mandated with improving conditions at the detention center. Most of the prisoners in the OCDC are held short-term, but some, like Budlakhadi, end up housed there for months or even years.
We're living in a hallway where they have tables, a TV, 24 other inmates. You walk back and forth in the hallway with four phones. You eat in your cell with no window to see out of, no table, so you sit on the floor. It's like someone outside lives in their washroom. They eat in the washroom, they live in the washroom. This is how we get treated here. You come on a range, the range windows, you have nothing, you can't see nothing outside the range windows or nothing coming in because it's caked on with desk and cells and dirt. You're locked up 21 hours plus a day in a cell, yet you're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty.
Prisoners stuck in the OCDC suffer physically and mentally. Budlakhadi, who has serious physical and mental health problems, has been forced to fight day in and day out for months in order to get access to medical care. Diana Ralph is one of Budlakhadi's supporters, as well as a social worker and psychotherapist. She was helping him before he was imprisoned and has continued to advocate for him afterwards. She has been particularly active trying to ensure that he gets the medical attention he needs.
I just would like to talk about how profoundly I respect Deepan. In these horrible conditions, he keeps his cool. He is constantly appreciative and respectful. He just keeps fighting. You know, he's not letting the system break him. No exercise, lousy food, dangerously crowded conditions with temperature extremes that are unbearable. That's enough to cause serious illness. But for mental health, it's much worse even. People are constantly being humiliated and told that they're worthless and bad and that they are powerless and that the arbitrary authorities can treat them any way they want. And they're isolated. It's almost as if you took a recipe for how to install trauma in people and they do it on purpose.
Budlakhadi will be in court at the Ottawa Provincial Courthouse on October 30th and 31st. Anyone who wants to support him is invited to attend. Regardless of the final outcome of his charges, he will remain stateless for the foreseeable future because the Liberal government has so far refused to restore his citizenship. Statelessness, says Daniel Kaylee Daou, a spokesperson for the Justice for Deepan Committee, is at the heart of Budlakhadi's suffering.
Actually, stateless had everything to do with the options he had when he was out of jail and why he was declared stateless in the first place through decisions, politically motivated decisions by both CBSA and the previous Conservative government to declare him stateless, and attempt to deport him to a country where he'd never been.
This has been a Groundwire production from Ottawa, Algonquin Territory.
You are listening to Groundwire's Year in Review, your source for news from the ground up, available online at groundwirenews.ca and airing on your local community radio station. Finally, our community radio report from our December 17th episode, where Gal Mahadevan at CKUT reports on a win for Indigenous voices as the CRTC rejects a new Christian music radio station, allowing Ganasatake United Voices Radio to keep its frequency.
In a win for Indigenous language and cultural preservation, CKHQ 101.7 in Ganasatake, a Mohawk language community radio station, is celebrating a recent CRTC decision. The CRTC denied the application of a Christian music station broadcasting in Lachute from overtaking CKHQ's frequency, jeopardizing the future of the radio station. Groundwire had a chance to speak to Sid Gaspé, co-founder of CKHQ 101.7 in Ganasatake. Here's what he had to say.
In April of 2018, we filed an intervention against the application of the Lachute radio station because they were wanting to use the same frequency as 101.7 FM in Ganasatake. And they were able to do so because we were on an unprotected frequency. We had a 45-page intervention. And in the intervention, we had to prove that the Lachute station would not get their license based on their application, not based on the technical aspect, because we had no leg to stand on from a technical point of view. So everything played out on a political level in this case. Because of our intervention, the CRTC took a closer look at the Christian music station's application, and they actually said in the decision that they didn't provide a quality application, and they didn't demonstrate an understanding of the regulations and policies for commercial radio and for religious broadcasting. So on those grounds, they denied their application. And with that, well, we had a great sigh of relief because we've been waiting since the hearing date of May 31st, 2018, and the decision came out December 3rd, 2018. Now we can go ahead and apply for a protected frequency. So the plan is to go for more than 50 watts and also apply for a new type of license. If we can get over that threshold of 50 watts, we will become a protected station. And that way, the Christian station in Lachute cannot come back with an appeal to their application. So they can do that. They can go back to the drawing board and learn from what they did and come back and absolutely try again. What this entails to get more power on the same frequency is to see how far we can go, because we're squeezed in between a bunch of other radio stations. So when you're looking at 101.7, well, you have 101.9 on one side and you have 101.5 on the other side. So you have to do a study through broadcast engineers where they will see how much power can you give without interfering with those stations. So we had a study done, but the study was just preliminary, so we have to put in much more money. And these things cost in the order of $10,000. Besides the whole issue around this application and the frequency, the station is no longer able to broadcast out of its location because the building is condemned. There's been water damage and the equipment's really outdated. So we have to fundraise. So we have to start from nothing, actually. We also have to apply for a nonprofit corporation status and set up a corporation with a board of directors and with a certain set of bylaws to regulate the corporation so that we can accept funding from different sources. We don't have anything. We don't have any equipment. We don't have any building to set up in. So there's a lot of money to raise to do this so that we can continue to invest in building and equipment. For those who want to know what's going on and keep up to date with our project, you can always check out our Facebook page at Reviving Ganasatake Radio. RKR is the acronym. Just punch that in and you'll find out there how you can help us fundraise for a new radio station in Ganasatake.
For Groundwire, this is Gaushika Mahadevan from CKUT 90.3 FM in Jajage or Montreal.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire's Year in Review, covering stories from the second half of 2018. We thank all of our amazing contributors this year and look forward to more community radio news in 2019. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwirenews.ca.